The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
With you, thought we would start with just to hear a little what's on your mind, any questions about your practice, about your formal meditation practice, or integrating the Dharma into your life. So it's open for a little bit.
Good evening. I'm having difficulty balancing the fact that I have goals with goals being goals as an endpoint, but balancing that with the process being what is.
Yeah. Sometimes when people first hear about the Four Noble Truths and they hear the kind of cheap translation of desire is suffering, you know, or all desire is suffering, which really obscures the fact that we can distinguish between wholesome desire and unwholesome desire, or between desire and craving. And I would say maybe the best way to think about it is that wholesome desires are distinguished from craving insofar as they can be fulfilled. Like craving's promises never come true. But desire, wholesome desire, aspirations, actually there can be fruition of that. And we want to watch how the mind is holding that goal, what we expect is going to change, and how that's affecting our mind. So I don't mean to sound depressing, but we Buddhists sometimes do sound a little depressing. I don't think it actually is depressing, but the mind that says, if only, you know, and the sense of this radical transformation of the texture of one's life that's going to come when we achieve this or that, or that mind is brings dukkha, you know, brings struggle. The psychoanalyst Adam Phillips said something like, there's nothing like success to show us we don't fully know ourselves. You know that experience of like, I got it. Right? It's like, yeah. I remember this in grad school, and some of the people in my cohort were like really excited to get their PhD. And maybe it's my temperament, but I knew the next day was going to feel like the day before it, right? But those who didn't, it was like a letdown. And so we have to be realistic about what our accomplishments or goals can do for the heart mind and what they can't do. I think over time we actually become more well calibrated in that way. Like what's going to be actually nourishing? So it's like we remember the First Noble Truth through the whole process. And we know that there is some planning and caretaking, but ultimately our future, the way we take care of our future, Thich Nhat Hanh said, is to take care of the moment. That's actually how we do it. We don't need to figure out the grand plan of our goals and where we're going and how we got here and what's gone right and wrong. And we take care of this moment. And that takes improvisation, and we can't know how that's going to be. There's no one Dharma mantra we can just march to, like how to take care of this moment, and I'll just do that thing. I'll just let go. I'll just be mindful. I'll just... No, it's like we have to be improvise, see what's skillful. But how we care for this moment, you know, you start to get a feel like, oh yeah, this is... I am creating the karmic momentum now. Any other questions or comments? Please.
So, you know, I've been sitting off and on for maybe 20 years.
Yeah.
And what I find is that... I go through periods where I'm living a life just because of demands, work, family, that it's just not supportive of having a practice.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I sit once a week on weekends. That's sort of the amount of time I can sort of open up for that. So I guess my question is, you know, what guidance do you have for people that are, because of their life circumstance, you know, I'm serious about the practice, but really busy.
Yeah. Well, let me ask, and I don't mean to be provocative in this question, but honestly, like, why do you practice at all?
Because it you know, it does give meaning, and it does give to what I'm doing, and to sort of refocus on who I am and why life presents what it presents.
Yeah. Yeah. And have there been times, has that been the general rhythm over the course of the 20 years of practice?
You know, there are periods where it's sort of more available, the time is sort of more available than times when it's less available.
And, yeah.
And, you know, there's no doubt that when you sit more and kind of read more and go to Sangha more, that it's present more. You know, I mean, that's clear.
And what have you done retreat practice?
Not since my daughter was born.
How old is she?
She's 11. But I've done 2 or 3 10-day retreats.
Great, great. Retreat. Get one in the calendar, even if it's for a year out. That's one piece. Because it helps clarify priorities, really. Where there's just sort of vivid depiction of we actually get to see how we're living, how that's an expression of our priorities, and in what ways that's out of alignment with something we know is deeply meaningful. You know, the fact that you've been doing it for 20 years, even though there have been time pressures and work and family, that's meaningful, yeah? And I can hear that it's important to you. Yeah. The other thing I would do would be to make sure you hit the cushion every day, even if it's for 10 seconds, literally, you know, like literally 10 seconds, because you would literally get, you know, you walk in, you sit down on whatever chair or cushion, and then you take about 3 breaths, and then you just get up, and you're done with formal practice for the day. And you do that as a way of keeping a kind of thread to the practice, and you'll get a sense of, just in those few breaths, what's going on with you, what's... you'll remember the Dharma, you know, and you may feel agitation or resistance or busyness, but that's meaningful too. So I would experiment with that, and each day, in a kind of formal way, even, you know, to sit down and be clear on your intention, and then you can get up very very soon after. But get the body to the seat. See what happens.
Yeah. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. Sure.
So I have found that, of course, with the practice, with regular practice, that reactivity I used to have is gone. But it's been replaced by this need to contemplate when I'm not meditating. You know, I feel as if I need some space and time to think about some issues that are current. Is that unskillful? Is that something I should be doing?
Say a little more about... So the reactivity has leveled out, but there's a need for some solitude and contemplation, and that's and you're wondering whether that, if that feels out of balance, or I don't know, but my feeling is we need as much solitude and contemplation as we need, you know, and maybe there will be a time when you can be fully in the busyness of life and that doesn't ruffle the mind at all, you know, and there's no need for solitude, there's no... That's maybe some idealized notion of things. I don't know many people who function well that way. There may even be something fundamental about our nervous system that, where the value of nature, of quiet, of retreat, of solitude, that this may be sort of woven into our biology. And so it's definitely nothing to be, you know, to be judgmental about or shy away from. If you feel like you're getting... it's disengaging you in some way from others or from, it's cutting you off in some way because you need a lot of solitude, then maybe stay a little bit more time and risk a little bit of reactivity, you know? Like, see, okay, I'm feeling the need to pull away. What if I stay, what comes up? And how can I work with that? But it sounds fine to me. It sounds fine. Yeah. How does that sound?
Sounds good, because I guess the more I meditate, the more I seem to be reading up about the Dhamma, and
yeah.
I have this need to reflect on what I learn in addition.
Yeah.
how it relates to my life, my issues, and so on. And that's why I need that time.
Great. Yeah, the Dharma is like a wildfire, you know. It wants all of your life. And that's just part of the path. Yeah. One more.
Yeah, it seems to want all of your life. This is my fourth time sitting for the 45 minutes. I just started a week ago, Monday, Thursday, Monday, tonight. And I feel very compelled to be here.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I don't feel any joy here. And I wondered if that was part of the whole process, if that comes back. Like, I was thinking of doing an immersion this summer. You know, in my own practice, my own traditional practice, joy is very important.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, it's one of the most important.
Yeah.
So you can achieve. And I just wondered if that's a component or it comes in somewhere.
Yeah. Thank you. I'll take it. We talk all about suffering, but we're all about joy. Yeah. And that's not apparent for a while, I think. You know, it's not. But we talk about it because in the Buddhist sort of psychology, the Buddhist model of happiness is not create happiness, create joy. It's dismantle the forces of suffering and we'll be left with much goodness. And so that organization of the psychology means that we talk all about greed, anger, aversion, delusion, suffering, clinging. More and more even those teachings, they actually start to take on a joyful quality. It just sounds heavy and it feels heavy, especially at the beginning of practice when everything is really so personal. And as we explore the mind and see how the forces that rule our minds are very universal, very impersonal, it like frees up the heart so that there's no more sense of heaviness or blame, or it's just like, oh yeah, of course we should be talking about suffering. My knee hurts right now. I'm afraid. And that actually feels relieving that we're talking about the human condition in a direct way. So there are other, you know, there are teachers that are more on the joyful, ecstatic side. And actually tonight, the topic that I'm, which is unusual for me. Normally I just talk about suffering. But tonight, that's a funny face. Tonight I'm going to talk about the fruits of practice. And hopefully this won't sound depressing, but we'll see. Okay.